This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It is officially pumpkin spice season, and I am known, both on the air and on Twitter, for loathing the pumpkin spice craze. But if we can raise $100,000 from Marketplace investors by October the 1st, I am going to drink a pumpkin spice beer on video. So consider yourself challenged. Donate today at marketplace.org/donate.
So if you thought Congress was moving slowly before, let's just say it's going to get a lot worse. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, September 22nd. Good to have you with us. And yes, friends, it is a lot. As of today, the COVID-19 pandemic has killed more than 200,000 people in the U.S., about the population of Salt Lake City. There are fires in the West, hurricanes in the South, and then there's Washington, where a Supreme Court nomination and approval to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg seems likely, as of today. But Congress also needs to approve a funding package to keep the government open. The deadline for that is at the end of the month. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams starts us off.
Congress and the White House originally agreed to what's called a clean continuing resolution, or CR. Basically, keep funding everything at last year's levels. But then the Trump administration said it wanted extra money, about $14 billion, for aid to farmers, aid that flows through the USDA's quasi-bank, the Commodity Credit Corporation.
And so Congress has to allocate that funding if this is really going to happen.
Ann Schechinger is an economic analyst at the Environmental Working Group. House Democrats didn't include that funding in their version of the CR. Schechinger says that's because, according to her analysis, a lot of that money goes to big corporations.
Billions of dollars over the last few years have been sent out to farmers by the Trump administration without much, if any, congressional oversight.
President Trump says the extra funds are needed to alleviate the impact of the pandemic on farmers. This debate could have been confined to another round of COVID-19 relief funding, but it looks like that's not coming anytime soon. John Newton is chief economist at the American Farm Bureau, which represents the ag industry.
And at a time when the farm economy is slowly recovering from coronavirus, now's not the time to deny the Commodity Credit Corporation with much needed resources.
While farming doesn't represent all of the rural economy, according to Benga Ajilore, senior economist at the Center for American Progress,
this kind of leads to kind of a broader issue of the agricultural industry and actually a broader issue of what's happening in rural economies in general, where you have large firms that have market power.
Whether those firms are big farming corporations, meatpacking businesses, or even manufacturing. Ajilore says the concerns of struggling farmers are real, but tying a solution to the annual fight over a government shutdown is not the way to fix them. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Today is the first day of fall. Usually that means a turn toward the holiday shopping season, which will look very internet-y this year. In a new survey from consulting firm AlixPartners, 45% of people said they plan to shop mostly online, a 15% jump from last year. Meanwhile, Deloitte predicts a 25 to 35% jump in e-commerce sales this holiday season. Now, this surge might seem like good news for retailers because at least it's shopping. But it's also going to be an enormous headache. Marketplace's Mariel Segura reports.
Let's say I buy my mom one of those robot vacuums for Christmas this year. Don't worry, Mom, no spoilers here, just a hypothetical. It'll be cheaper for whichever retailer if I buy it in a store. Because if I do it online, generally,
we don't pay any more for that product to be delivered to our house.
Rod Sides at Deloitte says we have all come to expect free shipping.
For me, if I get to the end of a shopping cart and I see a shipping charge in there, I'm likely to abandon the order because I can go somewhere else and they're going to include it in the price of the product.
But shipping isn't free for retailers. They have to pay people to take my mom's new vacuum off the shelf, pack it, and get it to my house. That's going to be even more expensive this year. Because of the pandemic, we are expecting a huge jump in online orders, and it's more than shippers can handle. John Bono is a managing director at Alex Partners.
These residential delivery companies don't have the trucks or the capacity to handle all of these orders.
So UPS, FedEx, and the U.S. Postal Service are all tacking on surcharges for business shipments this holiday season, ranging from 20-something cents to a few dollars per package. That's going to cut into retailers' profits. And this is not just about cost. Retailers also need to make sure they can actually get these packages to customers by the holidays. So they're renting warehouse space, turning stores into fulfillment centers, and trying to get you to shop earlier.
That means that you may see more promotion, more holiday sales earlier this season than in years past.
So instead of waiting until the day after Thanksgiving, they might start offering Black Friday-esque deals in October. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
On Wall Street Today, also shopping for deals? Traders. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you haven't tried TikTok yet, this still might be a good week to download it. As you recall, the Trump administration was set to remove TikTok from app stores last Sunday. Now there's a deal to kinda sorta Americanize the app and, in theory, protect Americans' data. The plan is for Oracle and Walmart to own a piece of the app. But TikTok also represents the first Chinese consumer product to really make it big in the US. So we asked two reporters to give TikTok a test drive in each country. Marketplace's Scott Tong in Washington and Jennifer Pak, our bureau chief in Shanghai.
For those of us who are not in the prime TikTok demographic,
which also includes me,
it's time to download this thing while I still can. Because if the Oracle and Walmart deal falls through, TikTok could disappear from American app stores.
And in Shanghai, I'll get the mainland version of it called Douyin, which means trembling sound. And right away, the app fires short videos, one after the other. Each clip plays over and over until I swipe up for the next one. Videos of pranks, people dancing and lip-syncing from the rice paddies. Not exactly my thing.
Yeah, TikTok isn't doing much for me either.
It's the e.l.f. Beauty Shield Recharging Magnetic Mask Kit. I can't wait to see if this works.
Swipe away. And with all these swipes, the app is learning what I like and what I don't like. So how good is TikTok?
I'd say it's pretty to the nose.
TikToker Jake Albalate is a college junior in Boston. He's got 30,000 followers. Of all the apps that tailor content to users, YouTube, Instagram, he says TikTok wins.
I would definitely say it caters the most out of the social media platforms that I've been on.
TikTok's customization is almost creepy to Ashley Weingarten. She goes to college in New York.
It's kind of like insane how quickly, I mean, I downloaded it within like days. It knew what TV shows I like watched.
She calls TikTok evil genius.
Well, technically, it's TikTok's algorithms.
Algorithms like how machines learn?
Yeah, TikTok and Douyin's algorithms analyze our habits, our swipes, our likes, and then feed us the next round of videos we might be into, like cats. The company behind TikTok and Douyin is called ByteDance.
ByteDance?
A very low-key tech giant in Beijing. It's been working to perfect its algorithms for nearly a decade. Its first big hit was a Chinese news aggregator called Toutiao. It has 140 million daily users in China.
That is a lot of data to process.
Which ByteDance uses to build its core algorithm. Du Chen is a tech journalist with the independent Chinese news site Ping West.
And with their content recommendation system, they can push content that is relevant to people in near seconds.
ByteDance's founder, Zhang Yiming, once said, this recommendation system has no borders.
Which is why TikTok has 2 billion downloads around the world. And American users tell me that the other thing big about TikTok is it's so easy to turn an idea into a cool video, which makes TikTok far more enticing than Facebook to Kavina Mears. She's a middle school teacher in Philly.
Okay, I see my cousin. How many times am I going to see her kids on Facebook? You know, but TikTok, it shows you so many different things. I've seen this one guy. He's a nurse. I don't know if he's retired, but he is the funniest guy ever.
And here he is.
We had a lot of love in our 80s songs. Stevie Wonder called just to say he loved you while Air Supply was making love out of nothing at all. The point is,
sometimes he posts 4 times a day.
And that's no accident. TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, sometimes pays creators to crank out videos. Ray Ma is the co-host of the podcast Tech Buzz China.
ByteDance operations team is very, very well known for incorporating their users into co-creating the product with them.
Good execution and tech innovation. For Americans, those are not things typically associated with Chinese companies.
The thing is, Chinese tech firms have to innovate, be nimble, because competition is fierce.
Wait, but I thought tech companies like Facebook and Twitter and Google, I thought they were blocked in China.
They are, but that still leaves tons of domestic competitors. Meantime, ByteDance has to appease the Chinese government. It censors questionable content from China users to avoid trouble.
In the U.S., TikTok is also accused of censoring content that makes the Chinese government look bad. That's one reason the Trump administration wants it shut down or partnering with American companies like Oracle and Walmart.
But let's say Washington can Americanize TikTok. Does that neutralize what it considers a Chinese tech threat? Again, here's Ray Ma from TechBuzz China.
A simple ban of TikTok doesn't really do anything, doesn't address the momentum that the ecosystem has accumulated. The Chinese tech ecosystem is far along enough that in several sectors, it's probably ahead of the U.S.
Ahead of the U.S.
So the next big thing might come from another Chinese company or ByteDance. Just so you know, Chinese TikTok already has a feature Americans don't have. A fruit farmer is streaming live on Douyin, hawking his juicy mangoes. Just click and buy in the app, which I did. And now I'm getting all these food videos.
Yeah, me too. On my TikTok, I saw this awesome barbecue video.
Beef so tender, you don't need no teeth.
I clicked like, and now it's all food all the time. I love this job. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong.
And in Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak
for Marketplace.
November 3rd, 2020 is still more than 40 days and 40 nights away, but voting has already begun in a handful of states, including South Dakota, Minnesota, Vermont, and Virginia. One of the ways we're keeping track of the economy this election year is through a series we call the United States of Work. It's 10 people we found who form a sort of representative sample of the labor force as a whole. Gail Harrell is one of the 10. She works part-time at a Royal Farms convenience store, volunteers with AARP, and as it happens, has some very other relevant hobbies in Loudoun County, Virginia. We haven't heard from her in a while, so we asked her to send this update.
In June, I probably kind of had like a little, I don't want to say a nervous breakdown, but it all got to me, this COVID-19. I mean, I kept going, but I was just down. I guess, you know, turning on the news each day, hearing how many people have died as a COVID. It really got me. So June wasn't my best month, but I kept moving. Still working at Royal Farm, continuous. I had cut back on my days to a couple of days a week, but I've kind of added on another day now. So I work 3 days a week, basically, and I work from 8 to 1, so I don't have a long day. Since the voting season has kicked in, I have been doing the absentee ballots, stuffing envelopes to be mailed out. For about 11 years, I've been working as a poll worker. This year is going to be different because I'm not going to actually be working face-to-face with people. I'm going to be working behind the scenes because of COVID-19. So I'm going to be counting ballots, receiving ballots, and things like that. I'm not going to be at the polls the day of the election. I love doing it, though. I feel like I'm helping people. I'm helping the world, and I can talk to people. I can tell them they got to get out and vote. When people say, no, I'm not going to vote, it's not worth, I'm like, yes, you are going to vote. You have to vote.
That was Gail Harrell, a convenience store cashier slash poll worker slash mood in Loudoun County, Virginia. Coming up,
our values do change what gets funded in this economy.
Bill Gates on the great power and great responsibility of philanthropy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average picked up 140 points, 0.5% to finish at 27,288. The NASDAQ lifted 184 points, 1.7% to end at 10,963. And the S&P 500 found 34 points, 1% to land at 3315. Buying the dip is what that's called. Kimberly Adams took a look at rural economies. So to extend that a bit, we look at some U.S. Census stats as reported by the USDA. It found that between 2018 and 2019, non-metro counties saw a very small increase in population, less than a tenth of a percent, but still noticeable because from 2010 to 2017, populations in rural areas had been in decline. Bonds essentially unchanged. The yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Looking to buy a streaming service? Quibi is for sale. Oh, Quibi. It launched just 6 months ago with a budget of over $1 billion. It was loaded with content, full of big promises and new technology. But yeah, things did not really turn out quite the way the company's founder, former Disney chief Jeff Katzenberg, had hoped for. Here's Marketplace's Erica Barris on what happened.
In case you missed it, and it turns out a lot of people did, Quibi is short for quick bites. Content longer than a TikTok video, but shorter than most of the scripted stuff on Netflix. Millions upon millions were spent producing Quibi originals. Chrissy Teigen's comedic court show.
Have you been injured on the job, even if it was your own fault?
Kevin Hart's show.
Here's my question. Why can't I be an action star?
Quibi boasted what they said was pioneering on-the-go screen rotation tech. Here's Chief Executive Meg Whitman talking to Marketplace tech host Molly Wood in January.
It came down to a kind of compression technology that when you are watching in portrait, your landscape version is compressed.
But what Quibi's been lacking is something pretty important. Viewers. Downloads for paid subscriptions hovered around 1.5 million in the first quarter it was offered. That's far fewer than the company expected. Tim Hanlon is an analyst focused on tech and media. He says Quibi entered a glutted streaming market with novel technology. Plus,
oh, by the way, creating a brand new company and brand from scratch that nobody's ever heard of. In marketing circles, that's a triple whammy of death.
As Quibi looks at sales options, there's the question. Who would want to buy it now? Quibi doesn't have that deep a catalog, and
it didn't have the customer data.
That's Carnegie Mellon's Mike Smith. And the data, he says, is probably any streaming platform's most valuable asset. And right now, Quibi just doesn't have enough. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Since its founding 2 decades ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has had a big impact on the world. Education here in the U.S., vaccine development and distribution globally. It's tackled diseases like malaria and polio and is involved with developing a vaccine for COVID-19. Bill Gates is co-chair of the foundation. He has a unique position in the world, having co-founded Microsoft, which made him one of the wealthiest people on the planet. I spoke to Bill about his work at the foundation, and I asked him about how a lot of what he does seems to be overcoming irrational human behavior.
The teams we build need to understand the cultural factors, the difficulty of delivery. You know, for example, vaccines, there's always rumors that vaccines are to sterilize people or they cause side effects. And in each country, you have to find who people trust, you know, make sure they're vaccinating their children and that they're spreading the word. So we always have to find a way to communicate and drawing in people with expertise very different than mine is critical to that.
Yeah. I mean, you're describing government level problems and you're describing, you know, some level of sort of cultural diplomacy. Why is that your job, the job of the Gates Foundation?
Well, when we started out, we mostly thought that we would just increase the R&D because, you know, for malaria, the people who die, which at that time was over 1 million children a year, they don't have enough money to have a voice in the marketplace. So there was no science or willingness to fund on their behalf in a capitalistic system. And there was a little bit of foreign aid, but not much. So we came in as the biggest player in malaria funding. At first, I thought our role would just be to create the drugs and the nets. But the delivery side, I underestimated how hard it was and how we would have to partner up to figure out what kind of vaccine would be acceptable, what kind of medical intervention. And that feeds back to the design of the product because you're a partner in the delivery and you see what's not working. You know, mm-hmm. We thought we could get women to take a daily pill for HIV prevention. And the uptake on that was very, very low. And so now we're working on something that you'd only have to take either a shot or a pill every 90 days because it looks like that would get uptake. But you know, you're driven by the limitations of uptake. And so that's why we've got to be deeply involved, not just in R&D, but also the delivery side.
Right. But to put a finer point on it before we have to go, at what point do your priorities, the priorities of the foundation, end up becoming the priorities for the world? And you've described a sort of, you know, series of unintended consequences that pull you in deeper and deeper to ultimately the work of governments. Like, where does that end?
Well, in no case should countries depend on our philanthropy or any other philanthropy to solve a basic need. We can accelerate the R&D and we can accelerate the understanding. And so, yes, by spending money on malaria as opposed to, you know, some fancy vacation or something, yes, the world's resources are going more into malaria now than they did before. And those million deaths are now down at 400,000. So rather than, you know, some luxury goods markets being expanded by spending, you have here the, you know, brilliant malaria scientist market is expanding. And so, yes, our values do change what gets funded in this economy. And malaria mm-hmm. just was, in my view, grossly underfunded. And I'm surprised that that was the case, but it created an opportunity to have really dramatic effect for money that, although at an individual level it's a lot, you know, relative to the global economy, to government-type budgets, it's actually quite small.
You said, you know, it was either, like, it could be either malaria or a luxury good. But there's, like, a lot in between there. And do you ever think maybe I should turn my lens on disinformation or wealth inequality or racism in the United States?
Well, we do spend, we have two big things we do. One is inequity in the U.S., which is a lot of that's education, and then there's global health. I do believe you really have to focus and become expert. Mm-hmm. We're basically saving a life for less than $1,000 per life saved. Some problems, governments spending way more than philanthropists can, haven't been able to solve. And so mostly philanthropy comes up with pilots, you know, pilots of a mentoring program, pilots of a, you know, how schools could organize a bit differently. So we do a lot of that. But once we've committed to malaria eradication, we're not going to abandon that. Sadly, mm-hmm. there's very few fields where you can save millions of lives for small sums of money.
Bill Gates is the co-founder of Microsoft, now the co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out, Amazon creates a lot of its own private label versions of popular items in its store. There's even been some antitrust scrutiny over it. But its latest knockoff, I gotta admit, is genius. Amazon is making a Prime branded stationary bike to compete with Peloton. The bike, according to CNN, costs $500. That is $1,500 less than a top of the line Peloton. Peloton sales have tripled since the pandemic began, but it might be headed for a bike wreck. Here is your moment of economic context on this Tuesday, and it's a hard one because there is a cost to everything. At the beginning of the show, I told you 200,000 people have died of COVID-19. Well, one estimate says for every person who dies from the virus, 9 surviving family members are grieving. So for 200,000 dead, that's nearly 2 million Americans in mourning. Our digital and on-demand team includes Ufuk Mehmetoglu, Olga Oxman, Beth Perlman, Erica Phillips, Brian Ronahan, and Tony Wagner. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Molly Wood, and we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.